Hello, welcome back to Medic in the Middle. Medic in the Middle is a podcast exploring a range of different topics, issues and articles based around pre-hospital care. It's hosted by myself, a registered paramedic and practice educator, Thomas Alderson, based in the West Midlands. We're really lucky today to be joined by James Yates from the Rhesus Room. I'm sure for listeners of this podcast, James probably needs no introduction. However, for those of you who don't know about James and the work he's done for paramedic practice, would you mind telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, James? And just for me to say quickly before we get started, it's really brilliant to have you on. And I really appreciate you sort of agreeing to come and do this as a long-time listener of the Rhesus Room. It's quite surreal, actually, to be doing a podcast with yourself. So thank you, James, for coming on.
Hey, honestly, no problems at all. I would say it's delightful to be here, but, you know, we haven't actually gone anywhere, have we? You know, we're just still sitting at home chatting over the internet.
Thanks to the wonders the wonders of technology. It saves the long drive down to Bath anyway. My fuel economy will thank me for it.
Well, absolutely. We're saving the world, you know, one step at a time. But no, I mean, honestly, it is really, really great to be here. And you know, thank you for that little introduction. And people definitely don't want to hear about me. They want to hear about this amazing, great topic that we've come to talk about. But
I haven't even told the listeners what we are doing today, actually, to be fair. That is totally my bad, but it'll be in the title. So we are going to be talking about neonatal management, by the way.
Oh, good. Well, that's what I prepped for, Tom, so that's a good thing, mate. Awesome. Well, you know, so why have you invited me here? I guess people might be wondering. Well, I've definitely been a paramedic for far too long now. But, you know, I've had an amazing career and I think this is an absolutely, you know, phenomenal career choice. And I think it still remains that. And I hope that people listening are on board with that idea, because this is, you know, it's tough times, isn't it, out there and in healthcare. But being a paramedic really is absolutely phenomenal. I couldn't have had it any other way, because I've had loads of opportunities. I've had the, you know, been lucky enough to explore loads of different areas of pre-hospital practice, and I've worked, you know, around the UK and abroad in several different places. So it's been amazing. And what do I do now? Well, I spend 50% of my time with the Great Western Air Ambulance Charity in Bristol, and another 50% of my time with the Southwest Neonatal Advice and Retrieval Team. And then there's another 10% with the Rhesus Room. So, you know, about 110%, like we all do, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
And so how does that look for me and my job plan? Well, I do 2 weeks with the neonatal retrieval team and 2 weeks in the sort of pre-hospital arena, and then sort of squeezing in the Rhesus Room into any sort of remaining time that's left. You know, and I guess you probably invited me here because of sort of maybe all three of those roles. But I guess people know about critical care and they know about podcasts, because here we are, but probably a bit less about neonatal retrieval. And so it's probably just worth having a quick chat about that, because I know, you know, it's raised quite a bit of interest, I suppose, across the paramedic community. So
yeah, and it's quite a new thing as well, isn't it, I suppose, for paramedics to be opened up to that role.
It definitely is. Yeah, it was tried once before, a good few years ago, up in the Northeast. But that was more looking at inserting paramedics into the sort of the nursing role, whereas the role that I've taken on is looking at putting advanced paramedics into this sort of middle tier of the rota. So working alongside advanced neonatal nurse practitioners and sort of pediatric and neonatal registrars. And we're sort of expected to work at that level. So I suppose very similar to an ED ACP. It sort of fits in with that advanced sort of clinical practitioner idea. But it is very, very innovative and unique. There's no one else in the country, as far as I know, doing the job that we do. And actually, at the moment, there's only me and a wonderful colleague, Lucy Hayward, who spends 50% of her time doing heart and 50% of her time doing neonatal retrieval. And we've got three excellent advanced paramedic trainees too. So, you know, the idea has been really successful. It's been really well embraced by both the retrieval team and the sort of the neonatal network in the Southwest. And so, you know, we're hoping to sort of expand it and keep things moving forwards. So people might wonder, you know, what is involved in this sort of neonatal retrieval role? Well, it's probably worth just starting out by explaining about how neonatal systems work, I suppose. There are networks that cover the entire country, I guess kind of like trauma networks, really, but, you know, for babies. Every neonatal network has to have a dedicated transport team. And so we are the transport team for the Southwest, and we cover the whole of the Southwest from Gloucester down to Truro. So it's an enormous kind of geographical patch. And within that network are a series of hospitals, and each one of those has sort of got different capabilities and levels of care that they're able to deliver. And they're sort of limited by the gestation of the baby, the weight of the baby, and then the interventions that they can deliver. And I guess there's some similarities there, aren't there, to sort of cardiac arrest centres and major trauma centres and trauma units and things. So, you know, some of the units, all of the units are really great at what they see and what they manage, but then they're less comfortable with the more unusual and the more sort of significant conditions. And what that means is that we as a transport team have to do two things. And the kind of the clue is in the title, I suppose, in that we give advice over the phone. And sometimes it will just purely be advice, and we will advise some of the hospitals who are lower down on that kind of hierarchy of care about how to manage their babies. And then sometimes they will need to be uplifted, and they will need to be brought for specialist interventions, either intensive care or for surgery or for cardiac or surgical interventions. And so that's what we do. We then go out, we retrieve these babies, we stabilize them on scene, and then transport them to the appropriate center.
On your vehicle then, so what's the team made up of? You've got this kind of like what I assume is like a DCA sized vehicle, that kind of square box shape, is that right? The kind of lunchbox shape ambulance.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, nothing too crazy, I'm afraid, to report on that perspective. But it's a good question. So the team overall is made up of three members. So we've got the transport nurse, the middle tier medic, who, as I've said, is either an advanced paramedic, an advanced neonatal nurse practitioner, or a registrar. And then we've got the neonatal consultant. And, you know, this is absolutely a team-based approach. But who is on the ambulance sort of varies as to the severity of the condition that we're going to go and collect and how premature the baby is, as two sort of examples. So the nurses are absolutely amazing. They will go out and they will do a lot of the babies who are sort of self-ventilating or on low levels of respiratory support. And then on the other sort of flip side, the consultants will come out and will be a three-person team for the really severely sick babies who are requiring significant intervention. And then there's this big sort of group of babies in the middle, really, that I will go out with one of the neonatal transport nurses, and I will be the clinical lead for that job. And I will take the referral. I'll offer any advice over the phone before we go. We'll think about how we're going to move the baby, whether that's via DCA or we do have access to children's air ambulance. So sometimes the helicopter moves. And then when we go out and we get on scene, I'll take the handover, assess the baby, work out any interventions that need to be done, undertake those, and then package the baby up alongside the nurse, and then transport them back to the hospital that we've already spoken to and arranged a cot at. So, it really is a really fascinating role. I love it for many reasons, but one of them is that I'm just always learning. Every single day when I'm out of that job, there's always something new crops up, a new condition, a new way of managing things. So really diverse, loads of responsibility, but enormously rewarding.
I bet it's quite interesting, isn't it, to have that multidisciplinary team approach, like you've said, just having those three different disciplines of practice coming together, and you're kind of constantly learning from each other, I suppose, aren't you, in that respect?
Oh, totally, absolutely. And, you know, the neonatal nurses are absolutely amazing at what they do. And then obviously the consultants have just got a phenomenal knowledge base. And then, you know, coming from the paramedic background and sort of comfortable with transport and, you know, planning ahead, thinking what might go wrong, working around those sort of issues. We all come together, and I hope and I think it works really well to deliver a really safe, effective transport team. And the other thing that I've been really lucky to be involved with is that because of sort of working in this pretty niche area, I've sort of become a bit of a de facto expert in sort of pre-hospital neonatal care, because, you know, no one else was doing it. So, whatever I say goes. No, that's not true. But because of that, I've been really lucky to get involved in some amazing projects. And one of those is working with the Resuscitation Council to develop the out of hospital newborn life support course, which has now kind of come to fruition. We've actually just agreed on some dates towards the end of this year and into early 2024 that we're going to start running the out of hospital newborn life support course. So, you know, that's one of the really exciting projects that I've been able to be involved with. But, you know, I think, you know, I could talk about this for all day long, mate, but we should probably, talk about, you know, babies and stuff, babies, and how to look after them, shouldn't we?
And stuff. Yeah. No, cheers for that. It's great to have a bit of context behind, like, kind of what you've been up to, and your background in this kind of arena, because it's not something that, I say, with it being a new movement for paramedics, it's not something that we're kind of all massively versed in, isn't it? So it's great that it's this opportunity starting to open up in that area for advanced practice and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, without further ado, I guess, kind of onto today's topic. So we're going to start off with definitions, because I think it's good just to set the playing field with definitions of the different types of patients that we might come across and the different age groups. And I think sometimes they get a little bit blurred between the different definitions of categories, don't they? So we hear words like neonates, infants, children, and sometimes the cutoff periods can be a little bit confusing as well. So neonates then. So neonates start from birth to 28 days old.
Mm-hmm.
And then the patient will move on to an infant. So that will be 29 days to 1 year old. From there, children, we move on to children from 1 year plus up to 12 years old. And just a little bit of kind of context, really. So in the UK in 2021, there was 694,685 live births.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's a huge quantity.
We don't think about it really kind of day to day, do we? Kind of how many people are born every year. So when I was researching this, I was like, oh, crikey, huge, huge numbers. Yep. But only 0.5% of all of those are born before arrival, or BBA, born before arrival at hospital. So only 0.5% of 694,000 are born pre-hospital. But even still, for us, it's a good job I used a calculator for this, by the way. This isn't just I've got super awesome numerical skills, but that means that still 3,473 babies are born out of hospital every year.
Yep. And I think the interesting thing to think about that, Tom, is, you know, 3,500 babies born out of hospital every year, that's 10 a day. That's effectively one in every ambulance trust in the UK every single day. Means that the individual kind of paramedic and the individual practitioner isn't seeing this on a regular basis, but trusts and ambulance services as a whole are absolutely seeing babies born before arrival on a daily basis, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, no, it is. And they are just the best jobs, aren't they? When everything goes well, and baby's healthy and mum's healthy, and I don't think there's anything for me that is quite as rewarding and an absolute kind of pleasure and honour, really, to be a part of that.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking, you know, while we were talking about definitions there, you know, you talked about sort of neonates, infants, children. And I totally agree. I think in reality, those terms get blurred and, you know, maybe it doesn't really matter. We just need to be clear on our communication, don't we, about exactly how old the patient is that we're dealing with. But there's probably another couple of sort of linked terms to some of those definitions that we should talk about. And that's gestation and prematurity. So gestation, that's the period of time from the conception to birth. And I'm sure you all know a baby born at full term is going to have a gestation of at least 37 weeks and maybe up to 42. Now, you're going to be offered induction of labour before you get to 42 weeks, because once you get beyond 42 weeks gestation, actually the risks to the baby become significantly increased. And so we tend not to leave mums beyond 42 weeks. And so that's full-term gestation, 37 to 42 weeks. And I guess conversely, the baby can be born prematurely and they're going to have a gestational age of less than 37 weeks. And it may be as low as 22 weeks. And I think that's a really important figure to keep in your mind these days, because actually that's changed, you know, relatively recently, because that's now the accepted kind of lower range of viability, which is, you know, absolutely phenomenal, isn't it? 22 yeah. weeks gestation.
I can remember when I started, it was 24, I think it used to be, and then it has, yeah, like you say, it's something that is kind of always changing. And then, like you said, I think when those kind of singular cases started coming out in more of a rarity, that we did, babies were being born, say from 22 weeks, and they were going on to, after like spending some time in neonatal intensive care, they were going on to sort of being healthy young children, weren't they, after quite a lot of intervention. But it still, it shows that from 22 weeks there is viability, as you say.
Yeah, no, totally agree. And I think, you know, it's just like all areas of medicine, isn't it? As medicine and interventions and our knowledge progresses, then we can do more and more for these babies. But I think, you know, at these lower limits of viability at sort of 22 weeks, it really becomes a balance between medicine and ethics, doesn't it? Because some of these babies do survive and some of them do well. But, you know, many of them won't survive. And some of the ones that do survive have got, you know, fairly significant disabilities. But, you know, I think that those sorts of dilemmas are not for us to necessarily debate in the pre-hospital setting, but I think it's really important that we're aware that 22 weeks is now the accepted kind of lower limit of gestation, and so we should be sort of actively intervening at that point.
Yeah, and I think it's something that as pre-hospital clinicians as well, when we hear the words, you know, we get a job come through and it's a maternity case, it's if we hear that they are kind of sub 37 weeks, we do, our heart rates are already going up that little bit extra, aren't they? Because these jobs anyway, as you say, they're quite rare to your kind of average DCA paramedic. They're not going to them every single day. So exposure to them is less frequent, and particularly when you hear there's a risk of prematurity, it does kind of spike that heart rate up in yourself a little bit more. So do you want to kind of talk us through a little bit about the prematurity and the risks that go along with it, just so we're a bit more aware of that conundrum?
Yeah, definitely. We've slid straight into prematurity, haven't you? But it's worth covering off these kind of these aspects of neonates that are concerning to people. It's like having a debrief, isn't it? Anything you want to bring up immediately, you've gone straight there, Tom. Straight in with the prematurity.
Well, I mean, that's it. We go straight in with the hardest problem, the hardest conundrum, and then suddenly when we're at full term, then we won't be so worried.
That's absolutely true. You know, and people might have got bored and stopped listening, so at least we can get the hard stuff in now. So, but it's interesting, you know, that you have picked up on prematurity, because actually it's really interesting to realise that actually the number of preterm births in the UK is increasing and is sort of steadily increasing. And it's now just currently under about 8% of all live births, which again doesn't sound like that much. But that's one in 13 babies who are born prematurely. So, you know, not actually that insignificant. And so why are we talking about this? You know, what are we worried about with preterm birth? Well, you know, I guess at the moment we're lumping all of these preterm babies together. And I think it's worth reminding ourselves that that period stretches from 22 to 36 plus 6 weeks. So that's a spread of almost 4 months. And that means that premature babies have all got very different needs and different challenges depending on how premature they are. But it's 22, also
22 to 36 is a long time, isn't it? As you say,
it's a long huge time. Yeah, huge amount of time, you know, and so within that period there's an enormous amount of development growth goes on. So they're all very different, but it's also important to remember that every single baby is different. And so if you take one 34 weeker and you compare them to another 34 weeker, they will have developed a bit differently, and so they're so it's really hard, I think, to give really hard and fast rules about these sort of premature babies. But I think it is worth saying that the earlier the baby is born, then the higher the chance there is that there'll be some complications. And I was trying to just sort of think, you know, when you talked about wanting to cover this, I was thinking, right, there's probably three key issues, I think, that we need to be aware of in the pre-hospital setting with these premature babies. So I guess the first one is that their sort of skin development is much younger. It's much more reduced. And they've got also a reduced subcutaneous fat. And because of that, we've got these increased rates of heat loss. And so that means that that's going to influence how we're going to manage these babies at birth. And we're going to talk a wee bit about that further down the line. But it's worth sort of highlighting, I suppose, is that our first intervention normally in a term baby would be to dry and wrap the babies to keep them warm and stimulate them. But in babies that are sort of less than about 32 weeks, that skin becomes so delicate that we don't want to dry them if at all possible. So we're going to put them into a plastic bag and then onto a source of warmth, either skin to skin with a parent or one of the trans warmers, those little sort of activated warming mattresses that we might have. But I think it's also worth saying, you know, what are these babies going to look like? Because, you know, I guess if you're sort of pre-prepared as to what they're going to look like, then hopefully it won't be quite so shocking for you and sort of cognitively overwhelming. So if they're born at 22 weeks. So, I mean, for a start, they're going to be really thin. They're going to have very, very sort of limited musculature. And they're going to have an almost gelatinous skin that's really, really delicate and sort of almost dark red in colour. And you'll also notice things like the eyelids will potentially still be fused together, so they won't be able to open their eyes. And then over the next sort of 10 weeks, so from 22 to 32 weeks, the skin gradually sort of thickens and strengthens. And that means that about 33 weeks and beyond, we can manage them by drying. So that was the first kind of limit, the first challenge of these premature babies is their sort of skin development. Another one that we need to be aware of is their sort of respiratory function. And we know that premature babies are at a higher risk of respiratory distress and the need for ongoing respiratory support. And I'm going to sound like a broken record, but that's because they're still developing, you know, and their lungs are still developing. And I think the easiest way to describe the development of the lungs and the respiratory system is that they develop within the womb from the trachea outwards. So the trachea forms initially, and then you get the sort of the right and the left bronchi, and then all the bronchioles, and then the respiratory bronchioles, and then the alveoli. And it's not really until about 28 weeks gestation when there's enough alveoli of forms to allow the baby to breathe by itself without support. And actually, amazingly, the alveoli in our lungs keep on maturing and developing even after birth, and you really haven't got a full complement of functional alveoli until you're about 2 or 3 years of age, which I think is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's mad, isn't it? Particularly when you see, you know, some of my young kids burning around the park and you think, wow, you know, they haven't even developed their lungs fully yet. They've still got a bit more speed in them. And the other thing around the sort of respiratory function is not just the alveoli, but also this idea of surfactant. You know, that kind of chemical liquid that's within our lungs that reduces the surface tension and allows our lungs to open more efficiently. Well, that actually only starts being produced around 24 weeks.
It's kind of it's like the WD-40 of the lungs, isn't it?
That's reasonable. I'll go with that. I mean, I'm not advocating WD-40ing these kids, but for the way it works, I'll go with that. So yeah, that starts being produced around 24 weeks, but often there's not enough for sort of good lung function until about 34 weeks. So that means obviously the alveoli collapse more easily and the inflation pressures are higher. So they've got an increased respiratory effort and they get tired sooner. So what does that mean for us? Well, our immediate actions after birth and sort of this assistance to transition that we're going to talk about is still going to be the same. But actually, once they've successfully transitioned, then they might require ongoing respiratory support or some supplemental oxygen. And again, we'll chat about a bit of sort of post-transitional care in a bit. And I think the last thing to say is that just talking of oxygen, these premature babies are also at risk of something called retinopathy of prematurity, basically damage to their developing retinas, which can affect the sight for the rest of their lives. So the risk of this sort of ROP, it's called, can be increased through the use of supplemental oxygen. That means that we resuscitate all of our babies, not just the premature ones, in air, unless we reach the point of chest compressions. And then once they've transitioned, we will talk in a bit about giving supplemental oxygen, but only to maintain SATs between 90 and 95%. So if at all possible, we're going to try not to give these premature babies oxygen.
See, I've heard a rumour that that was what caused Stevie Wonder to lose his sight, actually, was that damage to the retina at birth from giving too much oxygen. I'm not sure whether that's true or not. But
I was going to say, is that a fact, Tom, or is that a rumour?
Yeah, I said I don't. Do not quote me on that. That is rumoured.
Okay. It's alleged.
There is some things, aren't there, that we can be looking out for pre-hospitally. I think the Resus Council set out a few risk factors, isn't there, for premature babies. So when we're on the way to these jobs, or when we're kind of taking history from the parents, from mum, mm-hmm. there's things that we can be looking out for, aren't there, to kind of give us a heads up that it might be a premature birth. And those things, I think we would sort of talking about a little bit leading up to this podcast, so things like previous premature delivery, whether they are having more than one baby, if they're having twins, if there is a current maternal infection, whether that be a UTI, or some kind of urogenital infection or intrauterine infection.
Yep.
Using alcohol or smoking during their pregnancy, and then the age of the mother as well, because sort of less than 17 years of age or over 35 years. And I think a lot of women get quite upset about this, don't they? Because once they start creeping over the age of 30, they are, is it 35 is the cutoff where they're classed as geriatric or something like that? And they get quite upset about it, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I think I would, you know, getting geriatric mother at 35. Well, I was going to say, you were probably about to go on to what I was going to say, because we sort of touched a bit on transition, didn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to kind of pick your brains about this, really, because transition of a newborn is just mind-blowing, isn't it, when you look into the physiology of the fetus and the changes that go on through birth and whilst they're in situ in the uterus as well. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. So I'm not even going to try and attempt to explain this, and I'm going to leave that to you, James.
Yeah, thanks Tom. It's you're right, you're
Mr. Physiology here, so
yeah, they are absolutely amazing, and the changes that happen at birth is just absolutely phenomenal, really. So and it is complicated, so I guess we'll try and sort of distill it down and make it as sort of easy to understand as possible.
I've had my filter coffee, I'm ready.
Good. Yeah, I'm still halfway through mine, but I've got my notes, so let's see how we get on. So I think it's worth realizing that the physiology of the fetus in utero, so inside the womb, it is totally different to that of the newborn or humans at any other time of life. And that's because in the fetus, the lungs are full of fluid, so not gas but fluid, and the site of gaseous exchange is the placenta and not in the lungs. And actually, even crazier than that, blood's actually diverted away from the fetal lungs via two shunts that we call them. So these two shunts are called the foramen ovale, and that is an opening in the septum between the left and the right atria. And then we've also got the ductus arteriosus. That's a small blood vessel connecting the pulmonary artery to the aorta. So probably worth thinking first of all, I suppose, about why we get this diversion or shunting of blood away from the lungs. Well, I guess primarily it's because the lungs aren't needed in utero. You know, we've said they're full of fluid and the site of gaseous exchange is in the placenta. But why does it actually get shunted away from the lungs? Well, the fetus has got significant vasoconstriction of the pulmonary vasculature, and that means we've got really high pulmonary vascular resistance. But then sort of conversely, on the flip side, the systemic vascular resistance of the fetus is actually really pretty low. And so that results in the majority of blood either being shunted from the right side of the heart to the left through the foramen ovale, because it doesn't want to go up the pulmonary artery. Or some blood will go up the pulmonary artery, but then before it reaches the lungs, it then gets shunted down the ductus arteriosus and into the aorta. And so you've just got this really high pulmonary vascular resistance that's moving blood away from the lungs and back towards the placenta so that it can undergo its gaseous exchange. Now, that's all fine, isn't it? But having very little blood go into your lungs and having them filled with fluid is not really great for a long life outside of the womb, is it? So at birth, we need some pretty radical things to happen to the lungs and the circulation so that the fetus and now the newborn can actually survive outside of the womb. And all of that, all of the changes really are underpinned by establishing regular, effective breathing. And that is really important for us to know as pre-hospital practitioners, because if they fail to do that themselves, then we can help them with that. And that's going to help not only their respiratory function, but also their circulatory function and their entire kind of transition to being little humans rather than inside the womb.
Absolutely. I'm with you so far.
No, well, I'm really pleased because I'm not sure I can go back over that again. So what happens then at birth? Well, let's think about a baby that comes out and does well and we don't need to intervene. So sort of an uncompromised newborn. So they come out, they come down the birth canal, they're born, they make vigorous efforts to breathe and cry. And that generates really significant negative intrathoracic pressures, which drives the fluid out of the lungs.
Those are the ones we like, aren't they? Those are the ones we like.
Definitely. It's the only time you really want to hear a good cry from a baby, isn't it? But at birth is absolutely what you want to hear. And what that means, now we've managed to drive the fluid out of the lungs, is that gaseous exchange can now start to happen across the alveolar membranes. And that means sort of blood oxygen levels start to rise from an intrapartum sort of mean of about 50 to 60%. And they start to gradually rise to over 90% within about 10 minutes after birth. And the important thing about that is that oxygen is a really good pulmonary vasodilator. And so that leads to vasodilation of the pulmonary vasculature, a decrease in that really high pulmonary vascular resistance. And so you then suddenly get an 8 to 10-fold increase in pulmonary blood flow because there's not this massive increase in blood pressure that we saw kind of in utero. And then the other thing to think about is that clamping the umbilical cord and losing that placental circulation leads to an increase in the systemic vascular resistance, because actually that's a really low pressure circulation. So hopefully, Tom, you've now got the pulmonary vascular resistance decreasing, the systemic vascular resistance increasing, and that means that the pressure gradient that previously existed across the ductus arteriosus reverses or kind of just gets kind of nullified. And that means that we've got no shunting of blood across the ductus arteriosus and no shunting of blood from right to left across the foramen ovale. And so we get this beautiful kind of balanced circulation and a normal circulation that we would kind of anticipate to find in a child or any human once they've transitioned into sort of extrauterine life. And so that's it. That is kind of transition. And it's fully complete. And it was all because the baby cleared the lung fluid and oxygenated itself, because it's essential that we get that increase in oxygenation to get the vasodilation in the pulmonary vasculature and start to get the blood flowing to the lungs. So I guess that kind of brings up the question, doesn't it, as to what happens if the newborn fails to clear the fetal lung fluid and establish that normal ventilatory function? Well, then actually the status quo remains, doesn't it? The pulmonary vessels are going to remain constricted. The blood oxygen levels are going to remain really low, and the blood still is shunted away from the lungs. So if your baby that you've just been at the birth of is born apneic, or they're kind of gasping with really poor effort, then the newborn is almost invariably going to require support to transition. And that primary focus of that support, along with your thermal care, is establishing effective ventilation and oxygenation. And we're going to have a good old chat about that in a bit.
Brilliant. Well, I'm so glad that you were the one covering that topic rather than me, because that was a mouthful. But no,
hopefully it made sense.
It is amazing, isn't it, the physiological functions that go on and the changes to that go on through birth, and it's all going on by itself. And it's, I said, it is, yeah, it is really surreal, and it is very, very impressive. Anyway, I think it's worth mentioning as well, so when I was preparing for this podcast, come across this term called the concept of the golden minute. And mm-hmm. it is quite a simple concept, but I think, like when we're talking about, like we said, these are going to be really highly stressful situations, aren't they? And the cognitive demand is going to be up there, and it can sometimes scatter our thought processes a little bit, can't it? And we talk about with trauma, we're all used to like the golden hour and things like that. And I really like this concept of the golden minute. So, mm-hmm. So it was first called the golden minutes by Vento et al. In 2009. The following year, Ilkor emphasised the importance of the first minute of life using the term golden minute, so they use this term as well. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, Ilkor didn't actually specify when the golden minute starts. So Marshall et al. 2019, in the Journal of Perinatal Medicine, clarified this for us and said that the baby is born when the whole body is completely out of utero, and that is when the clock starts as the baby is born. So nice and simple, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, it sounds weird, doesn't it, to dissect it in that much detail, but I think that sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? Because actually we were just talking about the fact that as soon as the baby is born and it takes that first initial gasp, that's the very beginning of transition. So I think, you know, actually having the clock starting as the baby is born makes a lot of sense.
So at the start of this golden minute, then, what they're trying to get at is that those interventions that we perform in the first minute of that patient's life have or can have very important implications for long-term outcomes of that fetus, of that baby. Well, not fetus any longer, they are now a baby. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean for us? So the first minute of intervention covers all procedures that are carried out on the newborn patient after birth. So, and we're going to talk about this in more depth in a short while, but including the initial heart rate assessment, respiratory assessment, as you mentioned, correcting any breathing or ventilatory problems, cord clamping, and we're going to kind of come on to cord clamping in a little bit, aren't we? And heat loss prevention and thermal management. So we talked a little bit as well, and they mentioned sort of anticipating risk factors for neonates at high risk requiring resuscitation can decrease the time to resuscitation and improve the prognosis, which is why we were saying the risk factors, getting a good history, is really important, because if we're prepared for any complications and you've already kind of got that in your mindset on the way to these jobs or in the first few minutes of dealing with these incidents, then you're going to be more set up for preparing for those. A bit like, you know, we're doing a resuscitation and we're getting our kit dump ready and we're considering the airway problems and all that sort of stuff. It's a similar kind of concept. So just being aware of those risk factors that we talked about earlier. And all these things are really important for us to consider, aren't they? As mentioned, it's going to be hugely cognitively demanding. So it's just worth thinking about these things nice and early on. But the good news is, most infants adapt quite well to extra uterine life, don't they? So the Resus Council actually says that sort of up to 85% of these fetuses will breathe spontaneously and clear that fluid off their lungs without any need for intervention. So a further 10% of those will respond after drying and stimulation, which leaves just 5% will require positive pressure ventilations. And the intubation rates are very, very low, sort of between 0.4 and 2%. And fewer than 0.3% of all of these babies require chest compressions, and only 0.05 of them receive adrenaline.
I think that's really, I think those figures, you know, they do get banded around quite a lot, you know, from the Resus Council and on, you know, talks and presentations. But I think actually when you think about it, that's really, really reassuring for us as practitioners who are often out in the, you know, pre-hospital environment working by ourselves and dealing with these deliveries. So 85% just come out and breathe spontaneously and don't need any help to transition, which is phenomenal. But the ones that do need support, actually, the vast majority only need some support with their respiratory function. And that totally ties into what we've already talked about, isn't it? That is the key to helping these babies transition, keeping them warm and supporting their respiratory function. So I think that's really, really great to highlight those points.
Absolutely. So we talked a little bit about premature births. We've talked a little bit about transition. I think it's probably a good idea to, being as we did say that this podcast was going to be about neonatal management, so we probably should get a little bit onto the management of these patients. So how do we support these patients at birth then, or how do we support this transition?
Yeah, excellent stuff. So I think there's probably, we're going to break this down into two sections, I think, aren't we? So we're going to talk about the stabilization and support immediately at birth. So supporting that transition from in utero to ex utero life. And then we're going to talk a little bit about sort of stabilization of babies once they've sort of transitioned successfully. So let's start out with these babies that have just been born, and how can we support them? And I think there's three key things to discuss, and hopefully I'm going to start sounding like a broken record, because actually looking after these babies is not that complicated, but there's some really crucial bits that we need to just absolutely nail down and get right. And so the three things are thermal care. We're going to talk about a bit about delayed cord clamping. And then how we assess and support transition with a real focus on respiratory function.
Got to get those APGARs in.
Well, absolutely. Although, you know, I have to say, Tom, I'm not a massive fan of the APGARs, because APGARs is actually is interesting. You know, APGARs pop up quite a lot on our paperwork, don't they? But actually, it's actually a retrospective score.
Yeah.
It can be useful for us, definitely, in some decision-making with some of the interventions that we undertake on the intensive care unit. But actually, we shouldn't get too distracted with APGARs, certainly in this initial phase of the baby's management. So let's start out with our thermal care, shall we? So I can't really overemphasize how important thermal care is. And that's for a couple of reasons. So one, there's a 28% increase in mortality, and that is mortality as in death, not morbidity, for every 1 degree drop in temperature that the baby has below 35 degrees C. And there's multiple studies from different systems around the world, which sadly show that babies that are born before arrival do arrive hypothermic. So we know that hypothermia is very bad for babies. And then we also know that it is pretty prevalent in our group of babies that are born out of hospital. And there is a lot of reasons for that. That is not just the fault of the individual clinician. I think quite often, unfortunately, systems aren't set up and we haven't got the right equipment. But I think and I hope that is starting to change. So what do we do about this thermal care? Well, once the baby is born, then ideally we're going to place it up onto mum's abdomen so that she can see it. We can also give it a little bit of time on kind of skin to skin so there's a warm environment and we're not just putting them straight onto the floor or onto a sort of an unprepared cold surface. And then we can dry the baby, put a hat onto the baby, and then we're going to get rid of the dirty wet towel, wrap it in a clean dry towel or a sheet, and then we can assess the baby. And if it becomes clear that the baby needs some support to transition, then at that point we can think about activating the transwarmer. And actually, they're pretty good. They only take up to about 60 seconds to get up to temperature. So that's really our interventions for the term baby. So it's going to be drying them, hat on, wrapping in a clean dry towel, and then assessing them as to whether they need any support to transition. I probably wouldn't use a transwarmer initially for a term baby being born, but that might be a little bit different for the preterms. We touched on that earlier on, didn't we, Tom?
Yeah, so preterms, the management is slightly different. So the British Association of Perinatal Medicine have released some good guidance, and they've collaborated with the Royal College, well, the College of Paramedics, not Royal yet, the College of Paramedics.
There's also the Royal College of Midwives, and I think the Royal College of Nursing. There was a big kind of coordinated, multidisciplinary approach to creating this bit of work.
So they've put together this really helpful guidance for us. So the baby is born preterm and they do require some support with thermal care. They've said to prepare the environment for stabilising the baby, as we would do with any other kind of resuscitation job. Make sure you've got enough space, etc. Identify a clean and well-lit area. So as best as we can for us in the pre-hospital environment, I'm sure you've had experience with the trying to just make best do, really, in the some of the places that we visit. Put a heater on if available. So at birth, the baby should be placed feet first into a polythene bag with the edges of the bag brought up around the baby's neck before immediately swaddling the baby in a warm, dry towel. The polythene wrap may be substituted for a polythene bag. It does emphasise do not cover the baby's face or go over the neck.
That's a useful point, isn't it? Thanks for that, folks.
Yeah, don't just completely pop the baby in the bag.
Something to say around that polythene bag is that to make it easier, what we do on the transport team, and I think, you know, just to reassure people, this might sound really kind of arbitrary and a bit sort of Heath Robinson, doesn't it? You know, putting them in a plastic bag. So we do this on our professional neonatal transport team because this is all about increasing the humidity of the environment for the babies because they lose a lot of heat through evaporative losses because their skin's so thin. And so what I would do is if you know you're going to the birth of a preterm baby, you can get this polythene bag set up, and any kind of food grade polythene bag is fine. You know, don't get too caught up on whether it's a, you know, Tesco or Aldi or, you know, something more fancy.
Waitrose.
I mean, Waitrose would be ideal, I'm sure. But what I would do with that polythene bag is I would cut down the midline of it. And so that then as the baby is born, you can kind of lay them onto the polythene bag, bring up the two sides and sort of swaddle the baby, and then just put two bits of tape over the plastic to sort of almost create a like a sleeping bag, if you like. My experience of trying to put very premature babies into a polythene bag is that they're remarkably sticky. And so, you know, trying to slide them into a plastic bag is actually a lot harder than it sounds. So, I would just cut it down the middle. Makes it a lot easier.
That's a good idea, actually, yeah. They're going to be so small, thanks, aren't they?
Yeah. They are. I mean, I would claim that, but it's definitely not my idea.
Well, like I say, they're going to be so small, aren't they? Like, the logistics of actually trying to put them into a bag is going to be difficult, isn't it? So trying to make them a sleeping bag, I like that. So the next step they recommend, as you mentioned, put a hat on the baby. They're going to lose a lot of heat from their heads, so make sure they've got a little hat on. Place the swaddled baby onto a heated mattress or a trans warmer, and the baby should not be dried unless there is a delay in locating the polythene bag. If there's no bag available, the British Association of Perinatal Medicine recommend that we dry the baby very gently and wrap them up in a warm towel. And then it talks a little bit about deferred cord clamping is recommended, but I think you're going to lead us on to that, aren't you?
Yeah, that'd be great. And just before we do, I think it's really important to emphasize, and this is one reason why plastic bags, if you've been, you know, a paramedic for a few years, they've kind of come in and out of guidance for a little while. The main worry about putting plastic bags into pre-hospital guidance is that people, or the expectation was that paramedics or, you know, emergency care technicians or whoever's dealing with these babies might put the baby into the plastic bag and then just leave them. And the whole point is that you need to think about the four ways that anybody loses heat, you know, convection, conduction, radiation, and evaporation. And by putting the baby into a plastic bag, we're reducing evaporative losses and maybe some convective losses, but they still can lose heat through radiation and conduction. And so we need to put them onto a heated mattress. And I said for the term babies, I wouldn't use a trans warmer every time for them, but for a preterm baby, I would activate the trans warmer and have it ready. They stay warm for it's about 2 or 3 hours.
Long enough for what we're going to need it for. With most DCA,
yeah, I hope so.
Kind of travel times, isn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. So get it activated so that it's ready for the baby to be popped straight onto. Absolutely. Cool. So that was thermal care. And we said we're going to talk about delayed cord clamping. So ideally, what we're going to do is to leave the cord for a minimum of 1 minute whilst we assess the baby. So we said, didn't we, the baby's going to be born. We're going to put it onto mum's abdomen. We're going to dry it off, put the hat on, and then we're going to assess it. And there is really good evidence that delaying or deferring the clamping of the umbilical cord in uncompromised newborns for at least 60 seconds after birth is massively beneficial. And I guess sort of conversely to that, if the cord is clamped and cut immediately, then we can see a real sudden drop in the baby's blood pressure, and it can make them pretty unstable in that sort of transitional phase. And I guess, you know, why is that? Well, you know, don't forget that as breathing is established, there's quite a significant of movement of blood towards the lungs when that sort of pulmonary vascular resistance drops. So, and then that can sort of create some systemic hypotension. But delayed cord clamping allows the extra blood to be transferred from the placenta into the newborn sort of while that is occurring. And that keeps the blood pressure more stable. But actually, with a lot of things that we do for these newborns, and I think you touched on it earlier, Tom, there's actually longer term benefits to a lot of what we do or don't do. And so as an example, if we undertake delayed cord clamping, then it increases the amount of iron stores within the newborn. And iron's really essential for brain development. And what's fascinating is that these babies who've had delayed cord clamping, who then have tests of neurodevelopment later on in childhood, seem to do better than the ones that didn't have delayed cord clamping. So even that intervention, we can affect these children in a positive way, you know, for years and years to come, which is phenomenal. But that's the sort of the uncomplicated term babies. So what about the preterm babies? Well, again, actually, delayed cord clamping is a really, really high impact intervention. It can improve survival by 20%, and also then sort of goes on to reduce the need for inotropic support and decreases the need for blood transfusion. So really, really beneficial. So if you can, whilst you're assessing the baby and allowing that sort of natural transition to occur, then you can delay your cord clamping by up to a minute or longer. Like no one really knows quite what the optimum time is, but we just know that we shouldn't, if possible, do it immediately.
I think when I first started, it used to be, I think Chow Calc recommended it used to be something like 15 minutes, and I think they've moved away from that a little bit now because they've realised that was a little bit excessive. But,
yeah, absolutely. It's certainly somewhere in the first few minutes we'll be absolutely fine.
And you get a change in the appearance, don't you, of the cord as well. So when it stops pulsating, the colour of the cord changes to a more pale colour, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of discussions around how you can choose when to stop or when to cut the cord. And you're right, you know, one of the things is looking at the cord pulsations. One is looking at respiratory effort, the baby. But I think just for sort of consistency, the Resuscitation Council has gone for this idea of, you know, a minimum of 1 minute. So that's what we're aiming for. But all of that was around uncompromised term or preterm babies. But there is much less evidence and consensus for delayed cord clamping when a support to transition is required. So if the baby's on mum's chest and it becomes clear that the baby needs some interventions to help them to transition, then at that point, we should move to cut the cord sort of sooner rather than later. Because actually what we don't want is to impact on our interventions, which are going to help the baby transition and increase their oxygen levels and help them from not being hypoxic. So there's a bit of a balance. So the compromised babies, we're probably going to cut the cord. The uncompromised ones, there is no rush.
You mentioned there was three key things to discuss as part of the stabilisation process. So we've ticked off thermal care. We've talked about delayed cord clamping. The next one that you mentioned was assessing and supporting transition. So what are some useful things we can think about when assessing this patient? So what are we looking for?
Yeah, cool. Great question. Well, I reckon the best thing to do is to start with one of these uncompromised newborns because, you know, as you said, 85% of newborns fall into that category. And actually, just a few other stats to blow your mind. Around the world, there's 250 babies born every minute, and that's 130 million babies a year. But which is crazy, isn't it? But 85% manage with no help at all. So, you know, that's got to be a bit reassuring, hasn't it? But what do they look like? You know, what are these uncompromised newborns going to look like? So they're going to come out, they're going to move all four limbs, and they're probably going to adopt a flexed posture. So their arms and their legs are going to be flexed. They're probably going to cry, or certainly they're going to start establishing some regular spontaneous breathing without any assistance. And their heart rate, that's going to be assessed via auscultation with a stethoscope, that's going to be over 100 beats per minute. And most babies are going to achieve that within about a minute of birth. And that kind of goes back to what you were talking about, Tom, that kind of golden minute. So that is the uncompromised newborn. And I think hopefully relatively easy to identify. So what does a baby that needs help look like? Well, there's three kind of key criteria that we need to assess. There's tone, breathing, and heart rate, exactly what we just talked about with the uncompromised baby. So in a baby that needs a bit of help, their tone might be a bit floppy. They might be hypotonic, and that will be after any stimulation efforts. And what about from a respiratory perspective? Well, the baby might be completely apneic, or they might have these weird sort of irregular gasping respirations. I think the best way to kind of reference those and to think about them is looking at an adult with agonal gasps. And so when you look at the baby, if they are doing these very deep sort of whole body shuddering gasps, that is not a normal baby. You know, babies should just be breathing away regularly and without sort of increased effort. And then finally, the heart rate, we're going to listen to the heart rate with a stethoscope and we're going to look for that to be over 100 beats per minute. And if it's less than 100 beats per minute, that is a baby that probably needs a little bit of support. So just as a recap then, if any of those features are present, so decreased tone, irregular gasping respirations or apneic, or a heart rate less than 100 beats per minute, that baby's going to need a bit of a hand to transition. Remember, supporting these compromised newborns is all about respiratory function. Just remember back to that section on how they transition and the fact that the cardiovascular system sorts itself out after the fluid is driven out of the lungs and the oxygen level rises. So what are we going to do? Well, we're going to, first of all, just establish patency of the airway. And don't forget, newborn infants have got that very large head with quite a prominent occiput. They've got a bit of a short neck and they've got quite a large tongue. All of those things can make airway management a little bit challenging. And so the position we're going to put them in is slightly different to what we might try and achieve with either pediatrics or adults. What we're looking for is a neutral head position. So either flexion of the head or neck or hyperextension can occlude the airway. So what we want is just the baby looking straight up at the ceiling. And the way to do that is either lying the baby with their body on the transwarmer and their head off it. That actually works really well. Or you can put something like a folded up nappy or a little towel or blanket just underneath the shoulders, just to sort of compensate for that prominent occiput. And then we need to think about our respiratory support. Now, ideally, we're going to use a pediatric BVM with an appropriate sized mask for that baby, and we're going to deliver 5 inflation breaths. Now, what are these inflation breaths? More slightly kind of nuanced stuff just for the neonates. Well, these are sustained breaths over 3 seconds. So we're going to deliver them. And the temptation, whenever I teach on newborn life support courses, the temptation is that people count these out, but they go 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But that's not 3 seconds. So we need to make sure we do a proper sustained breath. So 1, 2, 3, breath. 1, 2, 3. And that's what we're looking for, 5 sustained breaths. No oxygen, just in air. And the key thing we're looking for here is chest rise. So after you've done that, so you've established patency of the airway, you've given your 5 inflation breaths, we're now just going to reassess those same factors again. So the tone, the breathing, and the heart rate. And if there's no change, and the baby's either still gasping, or the apneic, or the heart rate's less than 100, then we have to say to ourselves, well, hang on a second, did I see the chest rise? And if not, you need to repeat those 5 breaths, but change something. So either 2-person technique, change the head position, consider an eye gel if the baby's kind of a 32, 33-week baby and beyond. And you stay in that cycle of giving 5 inflation breaths and reassessing until you've seen the chest rise. And the whole point of that, the whole reason is that we know that driving the fluid out of the lungs and improving oxygenation is absolutely crucial. And so we can't skip that step and we can't sort of fool ourselves and say, well, yeah, I think I saw the chest rise. We really, really need to get that nailed down. But if the chest did rise after those 5 inflation breaths and the baby still remains compromised, then we're going to deliver 30 seconds of ventilation breaths. That's just normal breaths. So we're going to go about 15 of those breaths in 30 seconds. So 1 second on, 1 second off for 30 seconds. And if you've got the time, during that time, you could think about attaching a preductal saturation probe to the right hand of the baby to look at their saturations.
So those first 5 breaths, as you said then, so we got like the slower rescue breaths, I suppose, if you like, just to try and get that fluid off the lungs. And if that doesn't work, the 30 seconds of ventilation breaths, those are the quicker ones, aren't they, as you've said, just to summarise?
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really good summary. Yeah, absolutely. So 5 inflation breaths to really nail down driving out the fluid from the lungs, and then 30 seconds of ventilation breaths. And then we're going to reassess again. We're going to look at that breathing, the tone, and the heart rate. And if after 30 seconds of effective positive pressure ventilation, the baby hasn't established regular breathing, then we're just going to deliver another 30 seconds of positive pressure ventilation and then reassess. But if the infant's heart rate is at this point now below 60 beats per minute, then actually we're going to turn up our oxygen to 100% and we're going to start CPR. And we're going to start our chest compressions at a ratio of 3 to 1. So 3 compressions to 1 breath. And it's really important. I think we need to, we can't overemphasize that only 0.2% of babies require CPR. And so the vast majority are going to respond to our inflation breaths and our ventilation breaths. But if they do need CPR, then what we should be using is that two thumb kind of hand encircling technique for our compressions, because it's been shown to be much more effective. Although the two finger technique can be used in sort of a fairly resource poor environment, you know, such as God forbid, if you're a solo responder who's just helped with the birth of this baby and is now resuscitating them, that would definitely be a bad day at the office, wouldn't it? But once we've got into that cycle of developing delivering CPR, we're going to continue on reassessing every 30 seconds. And because what we're expecting is that the baby's going to pick up pretty quickly with our interventions. And then once the heart rate's above 60 beats per minute, the chest compressions can then be stopped. But positive pressure ventilation can continue until the heart rate is then over 100 and the infant sort of effectively established its own spontaneous breathing.
I like that. I like the way you've broken it down into like an ABC model. Just keeps it nice and simple and succinct, doesn't it?
It does. And it's not necessarily exactly how it's laid out, in the NLS manual or the NLS algorithm. But I think for us, transitioning ourselves from pediatric and adult resuscitation, it is actually still an ABC pathway. And you just need to make sure the airway's open and then absolutely nail down your B function and only move on to doing CPR if you haven't got the heart rate or the respiratory function of the baby to increase through our efforts at supporting their respiratory function.
Absolutely. So that was a really good summary, James. Thanks for talking about that, of the three kind of components of helping to stabilize the baby at birth. That was really, really good. I like the way you said you've done it in three sections. It's nice.
Cool.
We probably should talk a little bit about post-transitional care now, or assessments of the recently born neonate. So having a good structure of assessing these really, really small patients, it's going to help our assessment process, isn't it? And it's just going to help us be nice and fluid with the assessing process.
Yeah, no, totally. And this is something that is coming in with the out of hospital newborn life support course. And it's, I think, probably something relatively sort of new to us in the pre-hospital setting, this idea of, I guess, if you want to call it, post-resuscitation care for a newborn. And because there's still a few things that we can do to really influence the outcomes of these babies in the short term and the long term. But the good news is that that we've designed this to be very familiar. And so it's still an ABCDE model. And if you can imagine the ABCDE in brackets, and then it's sort of bookmarked, either end with a T at the beginning and an F at the end. Because what we want you to consider all the way through our sort of ABCDE assessment is thermal care for T and family for the F. And that's really the only difference. And so what does that look like? I'm aware we've been talking for quite a long time, so let's rattle through this, Tom. So the thermal control, I think we've made a good point of this, I hope, is that it should really underpin every aspect of care from the point of birth through to assessment through to transport. So maintain any existing thermal control measures, but plan ahead. So for example, warming up the ambulance cabin ready for departure. So then A, airway. So wherever the newborn is positioned, we're either receiving sort of skin to skin or lying on a surface, we always want to maintain that head in neutral alignment. It's very simple for the head to either flop down and you get the sort of the chin on the chest. And as soon as you get that, they can really occlude their airway very easily. So we need that nice neutral alignment. And if this is a baby, as an example, I suppose maybe a 32, 33 weeker, we said they were at risk of respiratory or ongoing respiratory support. So you've helped them to transition, but actually they still need some support with their breathing. Then actually you might want to put in a supraglottic airway device. And if it's in, then you need to just think about securing it either with a tie or some tape. When it comes to breathing, we're going to assess the baby's respiratory rate, anticipating kind of a normal range of 40 to 60 breaths per minute. And there shouldn't be any signs of increased respiratory effort. Certainly once that sort of, you know, first 10 minutes has gone by and they've really successfully transitioned, we shouldn't see any sort of subcostal recession, any head bobbing or nasal flaring. That would be a sign that the baby was working harder to breathe. And if we hadn't already done it, then we're going to put a neonatal oxygen saturation sensor onto the right hand or the wrist. And now that's because of all of that weird shunting and that ductus arteriosus. What we want is a really accurate reading of the oxygen levels in the baby and in the baby's blood. Above 10 minutes of age, all newborns should have a saturation of greater than 90% in room air, irrespective of their gestational age. So what about if it's not? What about if it's less than that? Well, if the work of breathing is normal, but the oxygen saturations are less than those target levels of sort of 90 to 95%, then we can think about some supplemental oxygen. Now, this is going to be a bit variable as to what kit you've got available to you. But if you've got a pediatric nasal cannula, then you can pop that into their nose and set the flow at 1 liter per minute for all infants. And then if you've got a term newborn, so those ones that are 37 weeks and above, then you can titrate the flow upwards to a maximum of 4 liters per minute. And that's all to sort of reach those target saturations of 90 to 95%. So that's A and B. When it comes to circulation, we just need to reassess that heart rate, listening again with your stethoscope and expecting a rate of about 140 to 160. And while you're there, pop your finger onto the chest, do a central capillary refill time, and that should be less than 2 seconds. So last couple of bits. D, we need to think about sort of disability and drugs. So we should take a blood glucose level off these babies, and we should be just doing a heel prick. And for these babies, we're looking for a blood sugar level of greater than 2.5 millimoles per litre, so lower than we would normally tolerate. And if the blood glucose is less than this level, then you can either give intramuscular glucagon to a compromised newborn, or in an uncompromised infant that's over about 34 weeks, either you could encourage some breastfeeding if mum is keen for that and wants to, or you could get just a blob, and this is not particularly accurate here, I totally accept, but a small blob of the 40% dextrose gel, and you can rub that into the buccal membrane of the baby's cheeks, and that should sort of help to increase those blood sugar levels. And then finally, E is kind of environment and everything else. So we need to take an axilla temperature. That's the kind of key gold standard for measuring a temperature in a neonate. So an axilla temperature. And we should then assess and adapt our thermal interventions to keep their temperatures between 36.5 to 37.5 degrees C. And then I think just thinking about everything else, any advice kind of regarding treatment or onward transport or destination choice, we need to think about going through our local pathways, such as maybe the neonatal retrieval teams, maybe receiving hospitals or sort of remote senior clinical support. And then plan your transport then with a particular focus on safety and ongoing thermal care. And I think we're going to round out this episode by talking about that a wee bit further. And then the final thing is family. You know, this, I think we can sometimes forget that this is a really stressful time for us, but not half as stressful as it is for the family. You know, they did not plan on having their baby either at home or in the supermarket or wherever you are with a bunch of people in green kind of staring at them. They had this lovely vision of giving birth with candles and whale music. So, you know, we need to remember that the family are absolutely integral to the care of this baby. And we need to talk to them. We need to keep them engaged. We need to offer them the choice to be present, either during our sort of transitional support or the ongoing care. And just sort of keeping them regularly updated and trying to develop a bit of a rapport with them. You know, and it's extremely stressful time for them. And just as usual, you know, our conversations should be really clear. We should avoid medical jargon, and we just need to be really empathic and understanding, and just doing all of the usual stuff that I think we're very good at in the paramedic profession. You know, keeping an open posture and friendly sort of body language is really, really key.
Brilliant. Yeah. I love that. I love the change of the algorithm, like you said, just adding those two bits in at the start and the end, just the T and the F at the either side of that A, B, C, D model. I think that's really good, actually, and it's something that, as you say, if it's coming in with the new neonatal out-of-hospital life support courses, I think that's a really good way of framing these jobs, isn't it, in your head? Particularly with the family bit at the end as well. I like that. I think it adds that humanity to it, doesn't it?
I think so, and I hope so. And I think it's, you know, understandably really, really easy to forget, you know, that the family are so invested in this job. So, yeah, I hope it will prompt us all to provide a much better, much more consistent kind of holistic approach to managing these babies once they've transitioned. But we said we were going to round out with a bit of transport, didn't we? Because this is always a bone of contention, something that's very controversial, and it is extremely challenging.
And it was an area that we had kind of questions coming in on Twitter as well, wasn't it? Asking about what would you recommend for transport, and it's something that we said we're going to try and clarify a little bit, because it is an area of contention and kind of ambiguity, isn't it, for some of the pre-hospital providers, depending on what kit they've got.
It definitely is. And I think it's really sad that we're in that state, because it shouldn't be. This, you know, these, we've said these jobs are hard enough, you know, at the best of times, but if we then have to think about, you know, the logistics and the safety aspects of transport, you know, that's not fair on us, and it's not fair on the baby, and it's not fair on the patients and the parents. So you know, I feel pretty strongly that we shouldn't be in this position, but you know, let's talk about it. So I think, first of all, if you have got local guidance, then clearly follow that. Don't listen to the James rule of transport, because that's what you need to go with. But what do I think about this? So I think, as a general rule, it's vital that, if at all possible, the newborn shouldn't travel in the parent's arms during transport, unless it's in a commercially available restraint system. Whereas there's one called the Kangoo Fix that allows you to do that. I don't think there's any ambulance trusts using that system. And so if you haven't got a restraint system like that, then I just don't think we should be doing it. It might feel like the right thing to do. It's really nice. Mum can maintain some contact with the baby or dad. But, you know, what happens in a crash? You know, the first thing that the mum or the parent or the carer is going to do is to let go and hang on to the sides of the stretcher. And that is just something we don't want to,
And it's all too easy, isn't it, to think, oh, it won't happen to us, or we'll have a slow drive in. But it's not really the point, is it? There's a...
No, absolutely. But then the difficulty is, you know, what do you do? I've thought about this a lot, and I've looked at some of the guidance, and I've tried to find the answer. And the answer is that there isn't a specific answer, but here's some options. So in the well-term babies who are just being transported to hospital for assessment by the midwives, so they can either be transported in a restraint system, if you've got one, like the Neomate or the ambulance child restraint system. Or alternatively, you might want to take them in a suitably sized car seat that's appropriately secured into the ambulance. Now, if you do that, then the best practice advice would suggest a rear-facing car seat that's reclined slightly. And that's because it gives maximum safety, but it also stops the head dropping down onto the chest that we talked about before. Either way, I would want to keep a very good eye on the baby. And ideally, I would pop a SATS probe on just to monitor their heart rate, their oxygen saturations throughout the journey. But, you know, you can't do that if you've got a premature baby or any baby that requires ongoing interventions or care. And so here, I think the travel harnesses are really the only safe option, and they should be used with the thermal control measures still in place, such as the thermal mattress. So we need to package them, and I've sort of trialed this. It seems to work pretty well, and I've done it with the Neomate. I haven't tried it with the ACR, but certainly with the Neomate, you can package a pretty small premature baby with the trans warmer, with some blankets, maybe surrounded by a tin, one of those little tinfoil sheets, and a little hat on their heads, and then sort of put all of that within the Neomate system, and it seems to work pretty well. But the problem is, I don't think they're necessarily available to everyone, and even if you have got them, the restraint systems do have their limitations, and particularly if we're talking about preterm babies, because both the Neomate and the Pedimate not that. the neonate and the ambulance child restraint only go down to about 2 kilograms weight. So that's about a 33-34 week baby. So if you have a smaller one than that, theoretically, you can't use them. Although, like I say, I have packaged one of the preterm mannequins in the neonate with all of their sort of thermal control measures in place, and that did seem to work okay.
I say, look, like, hopefully we'll be in the south, and we'll call up yourself, and you can come in your critical care neonate ambulance and provide us with a suitable travel adjunct.
Well, that is true, but we definitely don't travel light. You'd be amazed at the kit we've got for these little tiny babies. It's ridiculously heavy and complicated. So where are we then? Where does that leave us? So if you haven't got an approved restraint system, or you haven't got a car seat, or the baby's premature, or needs intervention, we still haven't had an answer, have we? So what do we do? Okay, so I think, and this is just my idea, I think you can get a vacuum splint, maybe a medium one, and you can then use it to create a box shape. I guess a makeshift cot, if you like. And then you place the newborn into it with all of their thermal control packaging, and then sort of nest them. That's what some of our neonatal nurses are amazing at. What that means is basically make them really comfortable, make them safe, make them supported. So roll up some blankets, roll up some sheets, and put them all the way around the baby. So the baby can't move and sort of rattle around inside this kind of makeshift cot, if you like. And then secure the whole lot onto the stretcher with a four-point harness. So they're effectively inside a semi-rigid cot that's filled with blankets, and we can still access them to either do our sort of ongoing respiratory support or just assess them, you know, and keep an eye on them as we're traveling into hospital. And I think the last thing to say is that on arrival at hospital, again, if at all possible, and I can't think of why you would need to, the baby shouldn't be carried into the department, either by us or by mum. They should be left on or placed onto, if they weren't there before, the ambulance cot. Because there's definitely been a few incidents where, you know, unfortunately, baby's been dropped. And so that just shouldn't happen. And so we should transport them in on the stretcher to avoid that happening. So I think in summary for transport, it's still really difficult. I really feel strongly that it shouldn't be. I really hope that, in the near future, ambulance services address this issue. But in the meantime, I hope that is some useful kind of tips and tricks that we can be pragmatic and use to make the babies safer.
Brilliant. I think really that kind of rounds up everything we've got to talk about on this podcast, haven't we, really?
I think so.
Unless you've got anything else you'd like to mention.
No.
We'll just do a quick summary then, really. We've talked about definitions. We've talked about prematurity and risks involved with identifying patients that might need some more intervention. We've talked about transition at birth and transition of the circulation with the fetus and the newborn. We've also talked about stabilisation. You mentioned those three key concepts of thermal care, delayed core clamping, and the assessing and support and transition. And then, as you said, we talked a bit about post-transitional assessment of the neonate. And then we've also talked a bit about transporting the patient and transporting them safely as well.
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty reasonable summary, Tom. Well done. It's quite a lot in there.
Well, thanks again so much for agreeing to do this episode. It's been immensely educating for myself, and I'm sure for people who are listening to this podcast episode. And it's been absolutely brilliant to have you on and talk about it.
Oh, not at all. I really, really appreciate the invitation. And, I'm always happy to talk about this topic, and I really hope it's been useful to people.
So for those listeners, please do go to follow us on Twitter if you've enjoyed this episode. @medicmiddle is our Twitter handle, where you can get all updates related to the show and more. So thank you very much for listening, guys, and see you next time. Take care.